Cambridge English, Advanced 3, Tests 1 to 4. Published by Cambridge University Press and Uccles, 2018. This recording is copyright. CD 2. This is the Cambridge English Advanced Listening Test, Test 3. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I'll introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you'll hear this sound. You'll hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You'll have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There'll now be a pause. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You'll hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1. You hear two newspaper journalists talking about their work to a group of students. Now look at questions 1 and 2.
My first job was on a fashion website doing blogs and soundbites. It was good to work with other people, but I found it unsatisfying and transitory. People kept telling me print journalism was dead, but I wouldn't have forgiven myself if I hadn't given it a go.
There's still an appetite for commentary, but people's attention spans are short. They want bite-sized clips and breaking news delivered instantly in accessible chunks. I do use social media, but 140 characters can't replace my in-depth interviews in a newspaper. It's my responsibility to present full facts and balanced opinions clearly.
I find chasing people for information puts me under pressure. You have to be persistent and meticulous in checking facts, and surfing the internet doesn't cut it. It's long hours, too.
You have to engage your readers. And to know how to package an article well, you have to work with editors to choose pictures and write headlines. On the downside, there are constant deadlines, and that's difficult to deal with.
At least we don't get bored. My first job was on a fashion website doing blogs and soundbites. It was good to work with other people, but I found it unsatisfying and transitory. People kept telling me print journalism was dead, but I wouldn't have forgiven myself if I hadn't given it a go.
There's still an appetite for commentary, but people's attention spans are short. They want bite-sized clips and breaking news delivered instantly in accessible chunks. I do use social media, but 140 characters can't replace my in-depth interviews in a newspaper. It's my responsibility to present full facts and balanced opinions clearly.
I find chasing people for information puts me under pressure. You have to be persistent and meticulous in checking facts, and surfing the internet doesn't cut it. It's long hours, too.
You have to engage your readers. And to know how to package an article well, you have to work with editors to choose pictures and write headlines. On the downside, there are constant deadlines, and that's difficult to deal with.
At least we don't get bored.
Extract 2. You hear two language teachers discussing the use of emoticons, the pictures many people use to express emotion in text messages. Now look at questions 3 and 4.
Humans have communicated through pictures for thousands of years. Think about cave paintings. Emoticons just seem to be a natural development.
I do consider carefully before using them, though, because they can be interpreted in a different way from words. Science tells us that pictures activate the right side of the brain, whereas words activate the left. So an emoticon may produce a different response because of this. You can send messages using strings of emoticons instead of words, and a system like that, maybe with its own grammar, could lend itself to being a universal system of communication. It could transcend boundaries.
Yet some people regard emoticons as frivolous. They're concerned about the dumbing down of communication. Well, it's true emoticons don't belong in the workplace, so you have to be aware of when they're appropriate. Personally, I think people who use them are perfectly capable of expressing themselves with words, but people do appreciate the fact that emoticons give them a different form of expression. Something almost poetic that complements written language even if it doesn't have a grammatical structure.
Emoticons may not be suitable for genuine deep grief or real anger, though. Imagine Shakespeare's plays written using them.
Humans have communicated through pictures for thousands of years. Think about cave paintings. Emoticons just seem to be a natural development.
I do consider carefully before using them, though, because they can be interpreted in a different way from words. Science tells us that pictures activate the right side of the brain, whereas words activate the left. So an emoticon may produce a different response because of this. You can send messages using strings of emoticons instead of words, and a system like that, maybe with its own grammar, could lend itself to being a universal system of communication. It could transcend boundaries.
Yet some people regard emoticons as frivolous. They're concerned about the dumbing down of communication. Well, it's true emoticons don't belong in the workplace, so you have to be aware of when they're appropriate. Personally, I think people who use them are perfectly capable of expressing themselves with words, but people do appreciate the fact that emoticons give them a different form of expression. Something almost poetic that complements written language even if it doesn't have a grammatical structure.
Emoticons may not be suitable for genuine deep grief or real anger, though. Imagine Shakespeare's plays written using them.
Extract 3. You hear two friends talking about a young professional tennis player. Now look at questions 5 and 6.
It amused me to read in the papers last week that he is, and I quote, charmless in character and not a cultural individual. OK, so he's not the sort of person you might wish to sit next to at a dinner party. So what do you think? He's not competing in the charm and personality championships. More to the point, the obsessiveness and tunnel vision, which seems to irritate commentators, is the very source of his greatness as a tennis player.
But he seems angry so much of the time. Will he be able to control this as he gets more mature, as many great players have done in the past? Possibly, yes, but it's not a prerequisite of success that he should do so, nor that he should be universally adored by the public. What's significant is that he possesses a burning desire to succeed and a competitiveness of equally fierce intensity. So is it any wonder that such a person will howl with rage at an error, either on his own part or by an official? And, of course, that will land him in a spot of bother with the authorities.
It amused me to read in the papers last week that he is, and I quote, charmless in character and not a cultural individual. OK, so he's not the sort of person you might wish to sit next to at a dinner party. So what do you think? He's not competing in the charm and personality championships. More to the point, the obsessiveness and tunnel vision, which seems to irritate commentators, is the very source of his greatness as a tennis player.
But he seems angry so much of the time. Will he be able to control this as he gets more mature, as many great players have done in the past? Possibly, yes, but it's not a prerequisite of success that he should do so, nor that he should be universally adored by the public. What's significant is that he possesses a burning desire to succeed and a competitiveness of equally fierce intensity. So is it any wonder that such a person will howl with rage at an error, either on his own part or by an official. And, of course, that will land him in a spot of bother with the authorities.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two.